I'll dispense with the questions that we normally ask. The material that you had for this previous Shabbat was on Rosh Chodesh. And Rosh Chodesh Cheshvan, I will have one thing to say about this. Basically, where we're going to go this evening will take us toward looking toward Shabbat, etc. And so tonight, where we're going to begin, is going to probably be in the book of Bereishit, if you want to go to Sefer Bereishit, book of Genesis. Now, I want to say something in the very beginning. I don't know who all is listening and who is not listening. So, Adon Gabriel, I'm sure you're listening. And you will have your community. I don't know exactly your community schedule, but I know you have your Sabbath meeting. You have your Sabbath meeting, and you will be able to discuss with them a couple of things that I want to clarify. Last week, we briefly discussed the idea of whether or not Abraham fully executed the sacrifice of his son. Now, prayerfully, this won't be difficult for some to deal with, because I say this with all reservation, that when you come to study here with me, I tried to take every consideration of your feelings and your views, etc. I am not in the habit of trying to throw something in someone's face simply because I do or I don't believe that it's true. And I'm very willing to say that I do or I don't believe in certain things, but I am certain all of you who are in this room have marital partners, and if you have a marital partner and you tell me that you agree 100% on everything that happens in your life, I will say, I don't really believe that's quite the truth. But just
I agree because you're lost.
Wow, Rabbi. I'm going to sit down with you.
Yeah, right.
That's good stuff right there, man.
You do need some pointers.
Well, to respond to that, Dr. Lesheva has a very, very interesting approach on life. She is more than willing to present her view for me to listen to. In the end, she says, it's your problem, because you're going to be responsible before God and as far as this family goes, and so it's your
That's
neck.
What my wife tells me, so it's all the same.
It's your neck. So the reason I say this is because just because you have a differing opinion doesn't mean that it's time for divorce, right? You know what I'm saying? So I say that with regards to those who study here, and I say this again with all reservation and true concern. I am not one who blatantly throws things in people's face and say, if you like it, you do. If you don't, you don't. That's never been my approach. But I ask people that when you come, please be open-minded to what I have to say. And you have every right to disagree and say, that rabbi is crazy, and there's no way I'm going to believe that. Exactly. So if you say that, that's fine with me. I have no problem with that whatsoever. I know that not everyone in the world believes what I believe or follows what I follow. If they did, this room would be packed out, and it's not, and that's fine with me. I'm happy with all of that. I came to an awareness a long time ago that not everybody wants, you know, to hear what I have to say because it's not for them. That being said, if you take some thought with regards to the things that we'll say about Isaac and Abraham, perhaps you have never heard this. Adon Gabriel said a week or so ago that he took and he read the material and he came to the place that he had never heard certain things before. And so here with the idea of Isaac and what has transpired on Mount Moriah, which all of you should know is the same exact place where the temple was eventually constructed, where he was offered. It's very interesting that it is also the place in Midrash where the soil for Adam's body came. Adam, if you remember that reading in the text, it will say that that God formed him out of the dust of the earth, and then it said he planted a garden eastward in Eden. Okay, so wherever Eden was, it was to the east, undoubtedly, of the place that he took the dirt to make Abraham from. Okay? Thank you. Adam, not Abraham. It might have done Abraham too, I don't know. Right. And this will also be very interesting because there's a place in Numbers, and I believe the quote is in Isaiah 46:10, where it says the end, basically say the end is in the beginning and the beginning is in the end. Now the reason I say that is because on Mount Moriah is the place that the temple eventually came to be seated. It is also the place that we call the Guf, G-U-F or G-O-P-H, however you want to spell it to announce it as, pronounce it as Guf. This is also the well or the repository of the souls. And there is an idea, two or three places in the Talmud, where it says that Mashiach, Messiah, will not return to the earth or come to the earth until all the souls of the Guf are emptied, or all the souls of that place are emptied. Okay? So it's very interesting that it also is considered to be the throne of God, which you who understand the construction of the temple understand that inside the Kodesh Kodeshim, or the Holy of Holies, there was an ark, there was a chest built there in the top of the box, as it were, is called the mercy seat, and that was the throne of God. And he said that he would commune with us, or he'd communicate with us from between the wings of the Keruvim, or two cherubim. Now, let's add a bit of a mystique. The Torah is a very, very interesting book. It does not mince words. So when it says particular things, it says what it needs to say. And it doesn't add words just for the sake of, you know, making a flowery translation or narrative or otherwise. So it's very interesting that you need to understand what precedent is when you study the Torah. So whenever there's a precedent set in the Torah, then you know that after the precedent has been established, then you can find in the Torah other places where similar things have happened or associated. So let's just take a short minute to ask this question. It says that he would commune with us, with the people, the world, as it were, from between the wings of the Keruvim to the cherubim. Okay? That's not a precedent. That's the second case. So now the precedent has to be, where do you see the first set of Keruvim?
In the garden,
right? Garden, uh-huh. To guard the garden. Mm-hmm. now your will should start to turn, right? Because you see the Kruvim at the gate to Gan Eden, and then it's interesting because there's no other mention of the Kruvim until we get to that place where he says to build the cherubim on the top of the ark, on top of the box. They were to face one another. So, if you have a precedent and you have the fact that the Kruvim, the cherubim, with quote, flaming swords, etc., were at the gate to Gan Eden, the Garden of Eden, and then all of a sudden you have here now a presentation of the Kruvim, and then God sitting between the wings of the Kruvim and communicating, you should be able to make a little bit of a connection or an association, and you would say what?
Perhaps the places that God gave Gan Eden.
Okay, so perhaps...
What I'm saying is, the place where the Kruvim are, that's the pattern to show them that that's where they're going to find God and everything having to do with Him. And if the present was in the Gan Eden, then that's where they need to go to find. And how to get to Gan Eden is through the Hermetic rules of interpretation.
Okay. Well said. Especially when we then come to discuss the rivers and the garden, etc. But let's break it down like this. The place where the Shekinah, the Shekinah, the divine presence is basically said to reside inside of the garden. And there's a considerable amount of speech inside of rabbinic material that discusses or talks about Gan Eden, the Garden of Eden, and access into the Garden of Eden. And there's a place in the Talmud where it says four rabbis went in, and it gives the scenarios behind them. But now, if you see that in the sin of Adam, Adam is expelled from Gan Eden, or from the Garden of Eden, and there two Kruvim, two angels, are there with these swords to protect and make sure that no one enters, etc. And then you see God, Hashem, sitting on the throne inside of the Kodesh Kodeshim, the Holy of Holies, between two Kruvim. You would also think that perhaps there could be another portal into Gan Eden. Okay? But now I gave you a hint that you perhaps have not put the pieces of the puzzle together. But I said in one place, Hashem took the dirt and He created from that dirt. He made the man out of that dirt. And then He went to the east and He placed him inside of a garden. So we have two poles, right? What poles do we have?
East and west.
So, if you think that there's only one access point to Gan Eden, then guess what?
You're wrong.
You need to reconsider that idea, because there's more than one access to the garden. And He tells you that there, basically, that He would commune with you. You know what happened in Gan Eden when God comes looking for Adam, right? Adam, where are you? The voice, the Shekinah, is inside of the garden. And so if the voice of God comes out of the garden, then the voice of God sitting on top of the mercy seat is the voice of God coming out of the garden. Everybody with me so far? Okay, now let's do a little bit more of the end is in the beginning. Okay, it's very interesting. Let's see if I can do this. Since I tried to play this game. We have in the book of Revelation a place, someone may find it for me, where it talks about there was a lamb slain before the foundation of the world. 13? I was thinking 12, right at the end of 12 somewhere, so you're probably right. 13 to 8, yes, thank you. That's what reminded me, I said that's exactly it. And all who dwell on the earth will worship him, whose names are not written. And all will this is a reference above to those who are worshiping the devil, and those whose names are not written in the book of life, okay? And then it makes a statement after this statement, Lamb's book of life, a lamb slain before the foundation of the world. Well, then I would conjecture and ask a question. Where was this lamb slain? Where did this blood flow to? Etc., right? Now you know that the word Adam, is associated with the idea Adama is red dirt. Okay? And we can also break the word down to Aleph. And then we have, I have to do it over here, a D and a M. Okay? So we break it here, and the Aleph is the first letter of the Hebrew alphabet. And whenever you see the Aleph, especially standing alone, you should think of?
God. What God?
Elohim, because it starts with a Aleph, right? So right here we have Aleph, and then these two letters mean?
Blood.
So somehow it has to be associated with the blood that is connected with the divine. Okay? So we have a lamb slain before the foundation of the world. Where would that blood have come to? It would have come most likely, hypothetically, to Har Moriah. And from there he took a man, and there the blood, most likely of the lamb, was part of the composite of Adam HaRishon, the first man. Okay? Everybody have all that so far? Yeah? Undoubtedly. This brings us now again to Isaac and the fact that in most circles, many people do not accept, Jews do not accept, and generally speaking in Christianity, I would say they do not accept the idea that Isaac was in fact offered as a burnt offering. Now let's say this. If you understand what an olah, a burnt offering, truly is, and the process that was followed to make that thing a burnt offering, you understand that once the animal is bound in the cords, you remember, you may hear, tie the offering to the altar, to the horns of the altar with cords. And so the offering is bound with cords. Midrashically, we know that Isaac is to have said to his father, make sure that you tie the cords very, very tightly, because if in the process of you making me a burnt offering, I flinch, as it were, then I could disqualify myself as an offering. And so another Midrash tells us that the cords were bound on Isaac so tight that if you saw the place that the cord that touched the flesh, that underneath the flesh was white. So you understand, you know, that a cord tied that tight is extremely tight because it's restricting blood flow, etc. Now, the idea then is that Isaac did not want to be disqualified. He wanted to, in fact, be a successful offering. And so what would Abraham would have done following this point was begin to initiate a fire, but before he initiates the fire, he has to slit the animal. An animal would be slit from side to side, and one swift and smooth flow of the knife, because it needs to basically cut both jugulars almost simultaneously and let the blood flow away from the brain. The blood flowing away from the brain has, and this is the way kosher animals are killed, the blood flows away from the brain so quickly that it's more as if, I guess the best way I can explain it is if the animal just falls asleep. He loses his consciousness and he's not conscious of any pain, and then the blood is drained. Opposed to the way that many of the animals are done, killed today, they're probably first, in many cases, stunned, and then after that they're slaughtered. The difficulty here is that when you stun an animal in that fashion, you have injected into that animal like a stark terror for a moment, and that permeates all the meat that you consume if you do it that way. So no wonder our society becomes more and more depraved, right? You know, to feed on things of that nature. Okay, so Hebrews tells us, Chacham Shaul says in the book of Hebrews, he leaves it emphatic. He did do it. Okay? No question. He doesn't ask you whether, you know, he liked your opinion, he didn't like your opinion. He said he did it. He offered up Isaac. He says that's exactly what he did. He offered him up. But one of the things I like about what Chacham Shaul says is because he emphatically says it. He says it emphatically, and he said that this is what happened. But he puts then in the mind of Abraham the belief in the resurrection. Because he says that okay, and I'm putting words in his mouth as it were, but he says, okay, if that is the case, and Abraham saying, you really want me to do this, then I have to believe that what you're capable of doing is out of a pile of ashes you can take and resurrect a man. And this is, of course, is exactly what he did. Not only in my opinion, but in my rabbi's, my mentor's opinion as well. And he was resurrected after 3 years. I add a few extra months, just kind of my preferential whatever. But he was resurrected after 3 years. When Rivka, and we discussed this a couple of weeks ago, when she fell off of her camel, it was because, and the sages say it was because she saw the majestic nature, and you hush, of her husband. And I said, and there are places where in the book that we mentioned last week, The Last Trial, where it says that she saw him basically coming from the realm of the divine, as it were, into the realm of the natural. Now, exactly what that would look like, I would have to conjecture. But I have a very, very positive image, and one that we perhaps all can relate to at least a little bit, in the fact that Gene Roddenberry was a Jew. For all those that didn't know that by now, right? Live long and prosper. And the thing that I always enjoyed was the fact that, you know, they get on this thing that is this transporter, right? Scrambles all your molecules and sends them out into outer space, and then somehow recollects them at some other point. How all that works, he definitely was thinking very Kabbalistically, okay? And so I think that what Rivka might have seen is something very similar to someone who would materialize on a pad from being transported from one place to the other. But if that sounds too science fiction for some, then...
Maybe she fell off, when she fell off the camel, she hit her head on a rock and kind of dazed her a little bit.
Is that what it was? Kind of so dazed and confused? She didn't know what she was seeing. You need special glasses for that or something, don't you?
She's in trouble.
I got this feeling that she's not too worried right now. She's still chuckling. Okay, so that is basically the opinion of some, not very many, but one of the things that you will read in this week's material is the fact that, as I said a few minutes ago, the Torah is very, very much about precedent. And so if there's a precedent, you can say, oh, but it happened before, so
it can happen again.
So if someone says, well, no, Isaac really wasn't slaughtered, and he didn't die, and he didn't get resurrected, then, you know, someone of Jewish persuasion could say, yeah, that's right. So if he wasn't, then we don't have room for Yeshua being resurrected either. Okay? But if you have an argument that says he did, in fact, resurrect from the dead, and you say, look, it's already happened once in Jewish history, right? So it's not a problem that it could happen again. Okay? Questions, comments before we move on?
It's a Pharisaic doctrine, so I mean...
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, it's...
Absolutely. The Pharisees, they believed in the resurrection, and so it was not a difficulty for any of the Pharisees to believe that, and it's very interesting you should note that, because in this week's material, we have to deal with the Sadducees, who did not believe in the resurrection.
Also, I don't remember if it's a Midrash, but it's a kind of an accepted thing that there was a time in history where, and I don't know if this is actually literal, maybe more metaphorical, but you may know the passage I'm talking about, or the concept, that given points in time in history, many, if not all of the Rabbanim could raise the dead.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
And raising the dead was not an uncommon thing. Walking on water was not so rare. It wasn't just one tzaddik, or, you know, it was a few different accounts of people doing things. Now, some of these things obviously were after certain other people walked the earth, so you could read into that whatever you want, but the point of view that resurrection was actually common, I was like, almost, if somebody didn't resurrect, it was like, wow, what's really, something's really wrong here, because this didn't work out the way we planned.
Well, let's keep in mind this too, okay? There's not a problem saying that Yeshua raised from the dead himself through the power of God, etc., as it ends up saying, but also it's not necessarily problematic to say that he is the precedent. Okay?
Right.
It's not, that's not a problem to say that, although in some arguments, in some schools to argue that, there will be an argument to deal with, okay? Whereas, if you have a precedent, then you can say that, yeah, we already have this precedent in Isaac, etc. And there are several places, even in the Arshul, if you read it carefully, the Arshul Chumash, you will be able to see that, yeah, it was by his ashes, Isaac's ashes, that it was done. But it's not problematic to make Yeshua the precedent for many things. At all. As a matter of fact, studying and understanding that he was one of the major influences of bringing back or bringing to the forefront the Masorah, the oral tradition, in that he stands as a precedent. But as being the one who was the very first one to open up the Torah, etc., that he only is an echo of Moshe. This does not denigrate him in any way. It's just that Moshe, in the prophecy from Deuteronomy, says the prophet will arise and he'll be like me. So if the prophet arises and he's like Moshe, then he has to be associated with the Torah and the lifting up of the Torah and showing the beauty and the wonder of the Torah. Okay? Are we okay with all of that? Again, it's not... I don't say those things in any blatant or brazen manner. I just ask you to please keep your mind open to the possibility. If you keep those minds, and if you have trouble with it, it's okay. Just set it on a shelf and say, I don't agree with that. That's fine. Set it on the shelf, and maybe someday you'll say, yep, he's absolutely wrong. Here's the reason why he has to be wrong. Or you may say, well, you know, that makes a little bit more sense now because I've studied this and seen that or whatever. Okay? Questions, comments before we move on?
Your Eminence, I find it very amazing how much this whole concept about the merit of Isaac and what he did throughout rabbinic writings.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And especially after, you know, really focusing on it. It's everywhere you turn.
Right.
So there's something there.
It's like there's something there, and it's like, shh, don't say anything. And then the silence becomes deafening, right? You know something happened, but nobody's just really talking about it. And so if you could really get, you know, the right individuals to go ahead and talk about it, you know, who knows what you'd probably hear. So it is very much so. I agree, absolutely. And the merit, that we live very much on the merit of our ancestors, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, Moshe, on and on, Yeshua, etc. Okay? So please do not think in any way that the notes... the ideas that we posit here is any way a denigration of Yeshua, because it is absolutely not the case. And in his resurrection, there are positive precedents that are set. Isaac is said to have come 3 years later. Yeshua resurrects after 3 days. So there's a little bit of something here to tell you that, you know, maybe it was... farther away, the resurrection that we're looking for is farther away at the time of Isaac, and therefore the three-year period, is what it is, and then Yeshua does it after 3 days, etc. Okay? Other questions or comments? Everybody's good? Obviously not.
No, I don't have a comment. Interesting to note that... Isaac went to the yeshiva of Hashem to learn the Torah, but it's understood that Yeshua was already walking perfect in the Torah. He already had a perfect understanding of the Torah. So that might be a reason why he wasn't gone for 3 years instead of 3 days.
Just possibly, absolutely. Wonderfully said. Now... This is where things begin to get extremely mystical. Okay, so everybody say that you have to realize and say that mystical, Sodic mystery, as you will find another idea of Kabbalistic mystery this week in the material, but Sodic, deep Sodic, John, the letters of John, the revelation. These are deep Sodic truths that the only way to comprehend them is to understand the symbols. And so when things are put in a symbolic way, then you have a information that is packed so full of imagery that you can't comprehend all of it. So, for example, if you could look into the dimension of the spiritual world and see all the things that Yeshua and Messiah was, I wouldn't know how you could possibly describe that. Because you're going to see a lion, you're going to see a lamb, you're going to see a king, you're going to see a priest, you're going to see, and you can just add to this list, keep adding to this list. But when you see him, he's all of those things at once. But you can see all of those things at once just by seeing him. And then just after that, the guys with the white coats come, long sleeves, and you're crazy. And you say, but I saw it. I know it's true.
You get a jacket out of the deal.
Yeah, you get a... And you don't get a pink carnation, but you do get a white sports coat. Well, kind of sports coat. All right. So there's very much to be said. But it's very interesting that now, as we said in the last week's material, and you could read there, that... when you go into that divine realm, if you have the capacity spiritually to do so, which you do, it just takes some discipline to make that happen, but you can enter into the realm of the divine, the spiritual world, and if you can enter into the spiritual world, then you can communicate with the angels that surround the throne of God, the four different types that are mentioned there, but not only those, but all the saints, etc., that are in that world. And now again, all of a sudden, you know, it's getting really spooky and people are thinking crazy things, but it's not that way at all. Hopefully, rather than being confusing, I've given you a little bit of inspiration to dig a little bit deeper into the scriptures and a little bit deeper into something. Now, I said much of that as a precursor to the material that you now have for this week. And one of the things I will not discuss any farther this evening, we will wait till next week to discuss this, is the fact that there's multiple levels of mysticism or secret. So, you think that Peshat is just plain, literal meaning of the text, and if I say, if that's your approach, you've already misunderstood the text. Because it is extremely difficult to understand Peshat. And so, on Sabbath morning, when we're in here, we're going through rituals, and you can see people doing different things in the rituals that are going on. They bow in a very peculiar way, and they say particular words.
Wear those very funny clothes.
Wear those funny clothes. And on and on and on. And we say that this is a normal mysticism. What's so normal about it?
It's practical.
What's normal is that we see it every day.
Practical,
except
yes,
we
absolutely.
Do. Every day, it's normal to us to see it, even if we don't understand it, because it is mystical, in a sense. It's spiritual, beyond our understanding.
So that you're saying that because I put on a tallit, that I'm doing a spiritual act?
Well, you're showing a physical representation of a spiritual act that's already taken place.
So is that the same thing as a wedding?
Yeah.
It's a physical representation of a spiritual reality.
Yes.
Okay. So now you understand Peshat. Mysticism. Now the question will be, is there such a thing as Remez mysticism? And now you understand that we say Kavachomer, and Kavachomer means there's a light of heavy, so you need to provide me with a text so I can do this and see that there is. And we'll say, is there Midrashic mysticism? How many of you ever listened to Rabbi Akiva Tatz? Anybody? Okay. Guess what? It's not talking so old. It's not so old. He tells you what it is. No, it's not Peshat. He tells you what it is. He'll tell you in most of each hearing that you'll hear him say that this is drash. So the dominant, you know, you hear what seems so absolutely so odic to your mind, and you think, man, this is so old, this is deep. It is deep, but it's not as deep as it gets because he's only talking about Midrash. So now stop for a second, if you will, and turn back to Chacham Sha'ul and his writing in Remez and say, are these things, do they exist in his writings? He says, I'm going to show you a mystery. He uses an analogy and he talks about the woman and the man. And he says, this is Messiah and his bride. And his bride is the congregation. So all of a sudden, the marital relationship is a mystery of Messiah. And if you don't understand marriage, you can't understand Messiah. And if you don't understand Messiah, you can't understand marriage. So now what I want to say is this, and I will close with this. I've already extended my time limit. This should be the capacity that we, as followers of Yeshua, are able to show to the rest of the world. I'm not chiding you, I'm chiding myself. But I hope for you that it will inspire you to become much more of a student of the scriptures in realizing that there is so much more than what we have settled for, understanding that many of the cliches are cliches, and we need to throw the cliches in the trash, and we need to embrace the book on the level that the book is to be embraced. His Eminence, my beloved Chacham, prides himself in academic terrorism, but I assure you this, he's not being a terrorist for the sake of being a terrorist. He's being a terrorist because he understands that there's a whole lot more to what we really understand. And he tries to cajole the imagination into looking at things beyond the level that we've looked at things in the past. So just as in the Sa'odic side, the rabbis say there's seven meanings. Another rabbi said, no, it's not seven meanings, it's 70 meanings. And another rabbi comes and said, you're all crazy. There's an infinite number of meanings. And so we say that about Sa'od, but we say that about all the other levels as well. This week you will see Remez mysticism and the argument for Remez mysticism. So maybe I have or have not accomplished my job this evening, but I ask you to begin to think outside the bun. Oh, that's Jack in the Box commercial, isn't it?
Hello.
Hello? Questions or comments?
This is just Randyism here.
Okay.
In the last year that I've been coming here, except for the last month, really. I've learned more than what I have ever thought that I would ever would. And I don't think you should apologize. With the way that we deal with people, the people that we deal with, in the circumstances that they're in, we are constantly hearing that they've lost their faith. They've constantly lost their faith. In the last year, my faith has grown more than I ever would have ever envisioned. Only for the simple fact is I'm learning. I'm not sitting there just reading what somebody has told us. And I honestly believe, since coming to this class, that this is why so much of the faith that the people are dealing with that they're losing for the simple fact is they're just listening to what other people have to say.
Well, one of the things that Christianity, and I'm not here to knock Christianity, it's the Western mentality, and I think we all can relate to that from sitting in front of the TV to listen to someone give a lecture, is we have become very, if you will, lecture-oriented. We want somebody to give us a lecture, and we want somebody to lecture us and give us all the goods and all the information so that we don't have to do anything about it. Unfortunately, that is not being a true follower of the Master. I really do believe that he wanted people to be more, forgive the expression, but more than the village idiot. He wanted some people who could really think. And he wanted people, his people, to be the ones that shined, and everybody could look at them and say, yeah, that's it. It's very interesting that we're given his... They're supposed to be Nazareans, etc. This is the name given, but it's associated with the idea of Nozrai. Nozrai being the guardians, the watchmen, the ones who watch and guard. But then, if you say this, you have to understand the idea of watching in Hebrew. And if we say that someone is Shomer Shabbat, we mean? It's not about the way he keeps Shabbat. It is. But we say, if he's that meticulous about the way that he keeps Shabbat, that affects his whole life. Okay? So when we say that somebody is Shomer Shabbat, we mean this person, he guards every aspect of his life. So I say that because this is what Yeshua was expecting from his Talmudim, what he saw in Hakam Safet, what he saw in Hakam Shaul, later who became one of his Talmudim, as it were, what he saw in Yochanan, what he saw in his brother Yaakov, etc. He saw this in all of them, and that's what he was trying to cultivate. Now, stop and think about this for a second. Even as skewed as Christianity has been throughout history, okay, where they took and they twisted the thing, look at how much light they brought into the world. Mm-hmm. Those following Yeshua and following the path saying he is a Jewish Orthodox rabbi, we can say, man, it got off track back here. Yeah, we can say that, but look at the amount of light that has produced in the world just even being off track. What would happen if we could bring it back on track? Absolutely. Absolutely. So... I know nearly every group has its idea that they're the elite. And I don't intend to try to play that game just because we're just another group saying that. I say that because I think that we all, and I speak to myself first, so if it's not touching you, it's touching me, is that we should work much harder. And when I say that, I say... trying to figure out how this is going to fit in my schedule, right? How this is harder work. I say, please, don't become complacent. Don't become complacent with your approach to the Scriptures. Take a very investigative approach to the text. And as Brother Randy said, don't just read it. You can just read it and it'd be words. But let's... you know, and I say this not just as a commercial. You can go to the bookstore where Ron Scott and Giratlana work. And I tell you, go and find something that will help you find a deeper awareness of who and what Yeshua was. Now, you could say, oh, but that's Christian stuff. I don't care. Go in there and look in my office. Not 99% of it's not Jewish. It's preferable for me to have that material. But for me to have, it's believe it or not, the Christian theologians, these scholars, they give away the goods. It's all there. You just have to look at it and say, I just didn't understand that this is the way that it should have been read. But they were exactly right about this point. So, if you go down there and you buy the first commentary by John Smith there, and you read it and you say, well, I don't agree with this. Well, it's not about agreeing with everything that you read, but it is learning to have a thought that is, let's say, more abstract, instead of just thinking that, yeah, one of our problems is we think that we know too much. We know it all already. When I was 32 years old, I was the smartest man on the planet. If you didn't believe me, just ask me. I'll tell you. And now, at 25, I'm going backwards. I'm not so smart anymore. Because men can do exactly what I did. Listen to somebody, for example, like Rabbi Akiva Katz. And, you know, he's got good points and bad points. But you know what? If he can take your mind and stretch your mind, then I sometimes prefer Rabbi Gottlieb, David Gottlieb. Yeah, he's a logician. Now that hurts my mind. When he can tell me out of the Shema, he can make all this work. My brain hurts. Literally hurts. So, got the little MP3 player. How many times can you listen to a 45-minute shear in one day? Trying to get a nugget out of it. Questions, comments? Yes. The person out of all history that, excuse me if I say this, but not denigrating Yeshua in any way, but the person that fascinates me the most is Eliyahu. Why? Because this guy is the most mischievous of all the prophets you ever saw. Because, you know, you're sitting there and you're muttering over some super divine mystery, and you know that you could never understand this mystery, and so you're like, God, you know, how am I ever going to understand this? And somebody pecks you on the shoulder. It's Eliyahu, it's Elijah. And he goes, this is the secret. This is the answer. And so he's always giving away the divine secrets, and God is like ready to smack him on the back of the hand or whatever he does to souls like that. But it's most interesting that he is most mischievous. Not that I should bear any resemblance to that remark. That was not why I was given that name, I don't think.
You know you were almost in.
Yeah. So I asked his eminence, I said, where did you give me Eliyahu? And he says, well, you know, I prayed about it.
Maybe he had foresight, Rabbi.
Yes, Genesis, book of Genesis. Let's boldly go where no man has gone before.
Chapter and verse.
This one, yeah. And you know, maybe one of these days I will graduate there. I've got a book back there in the library. I taught in California. I used to teach the adult Sunday school class for the congregation I pastored in. I taught on Genesis 1:1 through 14 for about 2 years. I'm stuck, so I don't know what to say. We have hashed out the idea already this evening that there is an idea of precedent. The beginning is in several things. Hold your finger at Genesis 1:1. Let's go to Shemot, Exodus chapter 20.
Like you have to go home, touch home base, and then you can take off somewhere else.
Yeah,
right?
No, we'll come back.
You always got to tag up.
Yeah.
It's a hermeneutic 20. Rule.
It's a hermeneutic rule.
You have to tag up.
That's a rule, at least in baseball, right?
And who loves baseball more than the Jewish people?
Well, God, because he said in the beginning.
Exactly.
Beginning?
In the beginning. The seventh inning stretch? Why is it in the seventh inning?
Where do you think the word cap comes from? Kappa, keepa.
My baseball capa. And verse 1, and God spoke all of these words, saying, I am the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Mitzrayim and out of the house of bondage. 20 and verse 1. Shemot 20 and 1. Okay. Now, if you will study the mitzvot, the commandments, and when you study the mitzvot, you understand that that was the very first mitzvah. I am the Lord your God. Okay, and so the rabbi said, out of this commandment, said that it is incumbent upon us to believe that God is. So that's kind of a difficult statement for you to be commanded to believe that God is, right? You know, we already believe that He is, but we're commanded to believe that He is, and so it's very interesting, but. The rabbis say then that out of this very one singular mitzvah commandment are all the 612. Okay, the first one being 1613. Everybody's with me, okay? I think my math is correct if I do that. So. It'll spit it out in a minute.
Okay, if you wouldn't mind.
I'll give it to you, okay? I thought we had some of those
creatures
from the other side try to communicate through the printers. Oh, I was just making sure I was going to get things correct. Okay, everybody with me so far?
It was just Gene Roddenberry.
Yeah, it was Gene Roddenberry. Wireless connection printing, you know, fax machines. It's all spiritual, right? You know, how do you materialize, you know, paper on one end, put it in a machine and spits it out, and then the paper comes out on the other end?
That's episodic, I don't understand it.
Yeah, me too.
We might ask Leonard Nimoy, he might know something.
I'll bet he does. So, out of this singular mitzvah comes the idea for the subsequent 612. Okay? So this is the precedent of God, and this is the way that God works. Out of the seminal idea or foundational idea of a particular thing, a spiritual thing, comes all of the spiritual wisdom, knowledge, etc. that we're trying to understand. Okay? Now let's go back to Genesis. Because you will understand that the idea here, Bereshit, is the fact that everything, literally everything, is in this seminal statement that is here in Bereshit. Now, scientists and theologians are battling back and forth about, you know, when this was. Was it 5,000 years ago, 6,000 years ago, etc., etc.? I think that, you know, Hashem, God, is like He says in Psalms chapter 2, He sits up there in the heavens and He has them in confusion and He just laughs. He thinks it's the biggest thing because everybody has to fight over whether it's this way or that way. And it supersedes our understanding of exactly what Hashem did in this process. But now the rabbis, if you study the right circles, I will tell you, the minute you open the book and you open up the Sefer Bereshit, the book of Genesis, that you have to quit thinking in terms of the literality and begin to think in terms of spirituality so that you can begin to see what Hashem, what God is trying to convey. Now, it's very interesting to me that if you will look at the first passage, it says Bereshit in Hebrew, and then you opened up all the subsequent, the four particular versions of hermeneutic that, which apply to Messiah's life, each of those in some way makes a connection to this verse right here. So we say in a way that if you do not understand, now this is where it comes back to slap you in the face, if you don't understand Bereshit, you don't understand Messiah. And if you don't understand Messiah, you can't understand Bereshit. Okay? So it's the catch 22. Messiah is in Bereshit, and Bereshit is in Messiah. If you take... I'm not an astronomer by any means, but I can sit on the deck and look into the sky, and I can see the stars in the sky, and already I'm confused. Because why are there those little patterns up there? Or we see the patterns, right? Maybe they're not in a pattern, but to us they appear to be a pattern, and then there are those who gave... given this pattern a name and that pattern a name. So the entire thing is a tremendous mystery. Now, if you want to contemplate something a little bit more refined than that, just stop and study the clouds for a little while, you know. How is that specific grouping of water molecules floating through the air at this specific place got anything to do with anything? So obviously those kind of thoughts can bring us to the place that we become immensely aware of how grand Hashem God really is and how much He is beyond what we can understand. So when I look at Sefer Bereshit, I am always enamored with the things that I discover in Bereshit, and I wish I was intelligent enough to say that I could logically deduce some things, but sometimes I just read the signposts, and the signposts are kind of pointing in a direction, and you finally come to a conclusion because somebody pointed you toward what you're looking at. So now I'm going to ask you a question. Let's read for a second. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. And the earth was without form and void, and darkness was upon the face of the deep. And the Ruach Elohim, the Spirit, the breath, etc. of God, the Spirit of God was hovering over the face of the waters, and God said, let there be light. Technically, He said,
The light that
was in the beginning is now was. Let there be. There was light. The light now doesn't shine, and the light that it's speaking of is another light. If we have a minute, we'll get to that. It said, let there be light, and there was light, or the light that was is now not the light that is now. That was clear. Everybody got that right.
It's called
Be Or, Therefore. So, and it's all in the was, Vehi Or. So then God saw the light that it was good, and God divided the light from the darkness, and God called all of this day, God called the light day, and darkness He called night. So the evening and the morning were Yom Echad. This is a day of unity. Okay, so when you see, it's very interesting because it doesn't say this is the first day. In Hebrew, it does not say that. If it wanted to say this first day, it would say Yom Rishon, okay, not Yom Echad. Yom Echad means like Shema, right? Echad, God is one. And so this is a day that is entirely one. Now we read here, and understand what I said to you a few minutes ago, that everything, all the seminal information, do you need this right now? All the seminal information is in this particular set of passage we just read. So now I'm going to ask you a couple of questions. Number one, let's read it again. Okay, so we keep it fresh in our mind. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. The earth was without form and void. Dark was on the face of the deep. And the Spirit of God hovered over the face of the waters. And God said, let there be light. And there was light. And God saw the light that it was good. And God divided the light from the darkness. And God called the light day, and the darkness He called night. So the evening and the morning were the first day. Now, if the first verse and this first section, which is the very first day, has the seminal essence of all the subsequent days, then we should be able to look into this particular piece of text and say, I can see this and I can see that, kind of romper room for you that, no, I see. Oh, what, you didn't do the romper room thing.
I know what it is.
I know.
Okay, never mind. It's kind of like pre-Mr. Rogers.
There's that BR-54. It's rather obvious when you read it that
way. Now, I'll tell you what I see, and then you tell me if I'm crazy or not. Right here I see that it is indicated, and not only indicated, but inevitable, that Adam would fall.
Because there wasn't only light, there was also darkness.
Okay. That's one answer. Very good answer. Any other answers?
There's always order out of chaos.
Order out of chaos? Or chaos out of order? Yeah, controlled chaos.
Yeah, there's always a plan.
Okay, so the question is, in the first five verses, how can we determine out of the first five verses of Genesis that we know that Adam had to fall? Now, I'm not in any way trying to intimidate anybody, so please don't think that. What I want you to be able to do is say, oh, I can see that, and I can see how that could come to be from this information. But obviously what I'm trying to get you to do is a little bit of thinking outside of the box and begin to think on a spiritual level. Now, understanding this, can you imagine for 1 minute what it must have been like when Yeshua was teaching his Talmudim Tzod? I know I can't. I'm not foolish enough to make that statement. You know, I might have got the shot. Maybe. But, you know, you condense about 7 years of teaching into just a short period of time, and you understand that, you know, what he's teaching his Talmudim on a level is probably about 6 or 7 times accelerated what we would experience in just going through a 3.5-year cycle. But these guys were mental giants. And if you don't look at the disciples as if they were spiritual giants, you're gravely underestimating these men. It's very interesting, excuse me for exposing, but the Catholic Church wants to say that these men, and I can show you the quote in the book, says that these men were by no means theologians.
It's universally accepted all Christianity.
Yes. So if you do that, if you say that, then what you do is you establish yourself above them so you can say whatever you want. They're the idiot, but see, I'm going to show you how smart I am, and I can say this or this. But if you truly could understand the depth of what these men understood, and I say here, I talk about the fall of Adam, and I say we can see the fall of Adam in these verses right here. We should also know that all four of, quote, the Gospels, they start off with this very verse right here. So in other words, from this very verse, they saw everything to do with Yeshua, with Messiah. Everything about him was wrapped up in these particular verses right here. Now, I'm not here to tell you that I'm going to answer all your questions about that. I'm just saying that this is how the level that they thought on. You know, and if we should, as His Eminence or many people say, if we just, you know, reach the height of their heel in understanding the depths of the things that they're trying to discuss, then we'll become, you know, perhaps a little more intelligent than what we are. We think that, you know, yeah, Peter, Hamshu, a Svet, was just this guy, this dumb fisherman that's, you know, floats around in the Kinneret, the Galilee, looking for fish. And, you know, he fishes all night, and then a miracle happens, and Yeshua tells him to go on the other side. But other than that, he's just a dumb fisherman. The same, of course, is said of, you know, Hakamshu. Of course, many people want to, you know, write and put feathers in his hat, and that's all good. But I say, no Hakam Safet, no Hakam Shul. Because I suggest His Eminence has given the seminal thought that Hakam Safet was, in fact, his teacher. You say that a couple times in church, and they'll probably look at you crossways, right? But it's there's enough evidence, and I can show you enough evidence to show you that, yeah, it happened. You have to understand the language. You have to look beyond what's in English and see it in Greek to see that it's there. But it is, in fact, there. And then one of the things that I have said, I believe His Eminence would concur, is the fact that, you know, we think that Yohanan, John, who writes John, the epistles of John and the Revelation, we think that he was this super spiritual giant. But I say, nah, I don't think so. I don't think John was the super spiritual giant. I think Hakam Safet was. And you find sufficient evidence, even in the book of Acts, to find that Hakam Yohanan, John, he's running around with Hakam Safet. He's wherever Hakam Safet is, wherever Peter is, there's John. Why do you think that John was always with Hakam Safet? Why was he always with him? All of the material that is in the book of John, the seminal pieces that are elaborated on in the book of John come from the book of Mark. Mark, Peter, Jude. Okay? That sound ludicrous? Well, there's a pastor not too far away. It says, not a problem. Read Mark 15 minutes. And I would say, he probably sides with the idea that, guess what, the disciples were no theologians. But I say, Baloney. Okay. So, taking into account that each of them could dissect Bereshit, the very opening passage, I'll take it one step further and say that not only in these verses can you determine that Adam would fall, you can determine from these verses that Messiah was necessary to bring tikkun for that sin, that problem. Does it sound like I'm far-fetched? Do I sound like I'm in left field somewhere? Yeah, and they'll say, don't go over there, that guy's kind of... One day they won't say kind of, they'll say...
It's because in the beginning there was a light, and when that light no longer was, another light had to come along and...
No, the light was. Was in the past tense.
Yes.
I'm just messing with you. You're right. Go ahead.
So one light to replace another or to bring about the wholeness, the echad of the day.
Okay, so now what you're telling me is that also in this, you can also see the fall of Lucifer.
Oh.
Right? And you said somebody had to take up that spot. And so someone had to take up the spot that he left vacant. Is that what you're saying? Yes. Perhaps you're not saying that. I'm putting ideas in your head.
I was saying that somebody had to take up the spot that Adam left vacant, but
I also
when Adam left the spot vacant, there had to be two to take its place, because there was a light and it was whole, and then when it wasn't anymore, there was a light and a darkness, and that made it whole. So there had to be two to take
its place. No, there was a light.
Yes, there was.
Okay. The light was in the past tense, but it still is because it was.
Yes, but that's...
But it was hidden at that time for the righteous.
Okay, still, stand by my answer.
And then there was another light that replaced... No, it didn't replace. It was a natural light, but it doesn't show up until the fourth day. But you can see that it won't show up until the fourth day and the first verse. Right?
Somebody did.
What I'm trying to show you is this. It's not a mind game. What you understand here is that when you start to see the separations and divisions and things breaking apart from the fact that they were created a particular way, you see all these things, then you can understand, okay, is there going to be a fall of Adam? Yes, there is a fall. Why? Because there's a separation, there's the division. You have tohu vavohu. You have chaos upon chaos. And so if you have in the second verse, and the earth was without form, and it was in a state of chaos, then earth can be... What does the word earth, what is the word earth in Hebrew?
Adam.
Adama, okay? So it's an association with Adam. So if Adam is a state of chaos, and you see Adam in chaos right here, you know that Adam has to come to a time of chaos.
He brought about the chaos. Intentionally
he did. So okay, but that's there. That's another place, and intentionally he did. We understand this, okay? Now some of you may say, what do you mean Adam intentionally sinned? Well, sure he did. Do you understand why he sinned? Do you understand what his sin was? We don't understand this. Usually in Christian circles we don't understand this because we don't understand this. We're not taught.
He wanted to redeem his bride.
That is one answer that is very accepted in Christian circles. That, yeah, he wanted to redeem his bride. And it's absolutely true. That is one phase or aspect of it. But why was Adam sin? Setting that particular definition aside. He intentionally took... of the fruit of the tree. When you read it clearly, it says that, you know, Eve was there. Chava has it. She takes it. And it says she gave to her husband who was with her. So don't think for one second he didn't know what was going on.
He wasn't guarding.
He wasn't doing his job, absolutely. Or he was doing what he intended. And so what is his intention? If he intentionally sins by doing what God forbid him to do, what was he trying to accomplish by doing an intentional sin?
To bring about the Messiah.
Before that idea, there's another idea before that.
To bring about the 613 mitzvot so that he had to
before
do
that, before that.
Well, now I'm just lost.
To bring about the need for those things.
To bring in that person, he has this idea in himself that, guess what? If absence makes the heart grow fonder, then I'll make it a little bit farther away. And then God will see how wonderful I am because I can find my way back. But what happens? He can't find his way back, so...
Sin takes you further than you want to go.
And so now we are here, what? 6,000 years later, how far do you want to go?
I'm not sure if this would fit in at the time, you know, at the shot level of Adam and the tree, or if it would be earlier. But where would the sages place, you know, because we say, you know, in that day Hashem will be one and his name will be one. did kind of the disunification of the name of Hashem happen there in the first five verses, or is that something?
Yeah, absolutely.
Or was that part of Adam's sin? Or does that require more explanation?
No, I don't think that a quote needs so much more explanation, but I say again that here is the seminal point for everything, right? So we can say, yeah, it was here, and in this we can unfold that there, but at the same time, then you can see it unfold in a different way by looking at what Adam does. Okay? Because you're absolutely right. Well, if you look, obviously, God is building into the fabric of all of creation this chaotic idea, but it's a controlled chaos. And for example, now I don't know if Clark is here with us, he might be able to answer this better myself. My brother-in-law is a electronics engineer for the Marine Corps. He said that, you know, the most stable vehicle, air vehicle, is one that has, like, you know, really nice wings and has something, but it's not super maneuverable. So you build a machine that is super maneuverable, it has to be extremely unstable. So how do you compensate for the instability?
I could mention something.
Okay, go ahead.
Fighter jet aircraft are extremely unstable.
Yes.
So we build computers and electronics that can actually fly them.
Right. Because otherwise, because it's more maneuverable as a fighter jet, which is what you're looking for, right? A platform that is highly maneuverable for combat. But if you put a pilot inside of that machine and you tell him, now fly this, he'll be a bucket of bolts and a flame of fire before he even gets off the ground. So what do they do? Exactly what he said. They put a computer in it that actually flies it. All he does is basically give it the intention of flying this way, go that way, etc. So what I'm saying here also is to the place that when we look at all this, there's chaos involved in all of creation. It's there. And it is the way that God built into the structure of the universe, this is the way He built it. Now, when we get there, we might have a conversation and say, why did you build it that way? Because it made it extremely difficult for us to live. But at the same time, you understand that in this idea, now His Eminence brings it to this. You always have the circle. You always have the circle. And you have the rectification. So if you have the breaking of a thing, then there's always the reconstruction of that very thing. Are you with me? So, keeping this in mind, now obviously you could see where Messiah would be in Genesis 1, right? Now, I will say this. Almost all Christian scholars, almost without exception, not 100%, but most, will say the first mention of Messiah is in Genesis 3:15. Okay, which is totally known to nearly everybody. The talks about the Messiah crushing the head of the serpent and the serpent biting or taking hold of the heel of Messiah, etc. Okay? That's it. But that's not the first mention of Messiah. Where's the first mention of Messiah?
The Spirit of God. It says it's the Spirit of Messiah.
Spirit of King Messiah. Somebody's having trouble, huh? Spirit of King Messiah in verse 2. So the Spirit of God, where it says the Spirit of God, is saying the Spirit of Messiah hovered over the face of the waters. Now, most Christians will tell you that this is you know, the dove hovering gently and carefully over the waters, brooding as if it was going to hatch an egg.
More like a pterodactyl.
A flock of pterodactyls. Okay? Because what is happening here is exactly what needs to happen for creation. It's a violent, turbulent thing that is transpiring. And when you get violent and turbulent things, you get heat. And when you get heat, you get this and you get that. And we all... Isn't it interesting we have to carry our heat with us? Right? We're getting so pampered now, guess what we have to do? We also have to carry our air conditioner.
Are you talking about schnapps?
Scotch?
Schnapps.
Oh, I thought you said scotch.
Carrying our heat with us.
Wasn't exactly what I had in mind, but I wonder how the astronauts would feel about that, you know, when they got up there and it was pretty cold and they... Wasn't quite what I was thinking. Do we... Now I'm going to go somewhere else and the tomatoes are going to start flying because I've given this really scattered lesson this evening. I can only give it the way that it came.
Hey, there's order in chaos.
Yeah, okay. Exactly. That's what we've been trying to figure out, right?
Just keep drawing the circle.
Yeah, I'm on page one, and here's my notes, so it's going to take us a little while to get through the class. You know, have you ever stopped to think about the fact that, you know, we've been to the moon, right? Will we go to Pluto? Will we go to these places? You think humanity lasts long enough we go there?
As well.
How much oxygen do we have in this particular world? We have enough to get us there? We got to take it with us, right? Just a question. Yeah, you know, I got bonked on the head more than once when I was a kid, so it's okay.
What more oxygen here than in Los Angeles?
Good point. Well. Perhaps not. You just see the oxygen that you breathe there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
More good oxygen. Let me say that.
That's right. It's not yellow here. Huh? It's yellow there. Okay. I have not intended by any means to be in any way confusing, but I hope to be somewhat awe-inspiring, and hopefully you won't throw tomatoes tonight when you leave. But to understand that this is the depth of intelligence that Yeshua's Talmudim had, but amplify that now when you begin to see Moshe, you begin to see Ezra, you begin to see Yeshua, Yochanan, Hakam Tzafet, you begin to see all of these people and come to a place that when we think we know so much about the Scripture, and we come to a fact that we can take and dissect a piece of text like this and say that in this simple piece of text, the entire seminal history of our cosmos exists. And then if we can dissect it and understand it, then we could understand how to repair it, etc. It's there. Can I pretend to know it? I do not, and I'm not trying to play that game this evening. But what I'm telling you that is that it's time to grow up and start thinking more thinking, because we let people just tell us what to think. And we should not let people tell us what to think. We should be willing to throw the book across the room if it disagrees with my theology, right?
Then
go back and pick it up and see if I can tolerate one more page of this before I go to the next place.